welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
I'm Kathleen McGowan.
And we are very happy to have Kathleen back because after landing back into LA 2 weeks ago from our trip to Italy and France, which we're going to devote most of today's shows about, you were seconded to all radio stations across America because while we were abroad, The Poet Prince got launched and you had to do the promotion. So how has it been going? What are the early reactions to The Poet Prince?
Well, it's been extraordinary, actually. It's been very exciting and extremely positive. I mean, this is my fourth book tour, so it's been interesting to watch the evolution of it. My third book for fiction, my fourth book in total. But in terms of the fiction, this is book three in my Magdalene Lines series, and it's been very, very interesting to watch the evolution over the last couple of years. I'm not sure if it is... if it's a commentary on what's happening out there in the world, sort of spiritually, mentally, and emotionally, but I hope that it is, because, you know, I've really been analyzing the difference. And when I went on my first tour with The Expected One back in 2006, that was a really rough ride. Everything about it was difficult. I was getting death threats. You know, the call-ins to the radio shows were angry, and you know, I was accused of being on the Da Vinci Code bandwagon, even though I've been doing this work for 20 years. There was a lot of that, you know, anti-Magdalene stuff. You know, how dare you say these things about Jesus being married? Everything about it was just, you know, kind of over the top reactionary. And then with the Book of Love, it was a little bit better. I only had one really awful radio interview with the Book of Love with someone in the South who actually was a former Baptist minister who was not at all happy with what I was saying about Jesus's more Gnostic teachings. But I did see definitely an improvement from the earlier years of The Expected One. But now, here we are in 2010, and I have written this book, The Poet Prince, about the birth of the Renaissance, and I have had nothing but joy in these interviews. There has been no negativity. I mean, there's the occasional question about, you know, why is this different from the Da Vinci Code? But I welcome those questions because they're valid and they're important. And in fact, what I've discovered is the elephant in the room is always the Da Vinci Code, especially when you're talking about art. The Poet Prince is all about the hidden clues in art. So I think it's important that I get out there and tell people, here's why this isn't the Da Vinci Code, but here's also why if you loved the Da Vinci Code, you must read this book, because it doesn't stop at Leonardo. And I definitely want to talk about that a little bit.
Well, and definitely because we ended up by a series of coincidences of being led in our trip in France, specifically at Leonardo's grave. And what we actually found was that... there is so much more mystery hanging above Leonardo and his actual grave, which is so more interesting than the man himself. And we probably don't have time to go into that right here, right now, but we're definitely going to come back to that in a later show. So, yes, everybody seems to be asking, what is the difference between Leonardo, the Da Vinci Code, and this book? And what is the short answer?
Have you met me? There is no short answer, ever. But here it is. Listen, you know, one of the things I say in The Poet Prince, and just for those of you who are not familiar, perhaps, with my latest book, The Poet Prince refers to Lorenzo de' Medici. He is the Poet Prince. Lorenzo de' Medici is the great godfather of the Renaissance. He is the man behind the scenes. He was the man who was the shepherd. He shepherded these artists. He took care of them. He was their patron. He was their friend. He took care of their education. And really his grandfather before him, the great Cosimo de' Medici, was the one who really laid all the foundations for this. I go into great detail about how it was not a coincidence. See, this is one of the things that's really important about that book and why this book is important today. Because one of the things that we're talking about, it is not a coincidence that the most extraordinary minds and talent in human history all found themselves in one place at one time. Florence is a very concentrated space. It's not that big. So for the greatest philosophers, the greatest writers, the greatest artists, the greatest sculptors to all be in one place at one time was not a coincidence. That is a big piece of what I'm writing about. It was a divine plan. But it was a divine plan that was understood by the humans who were a part of it. And that's what I'm talking about. The Medici understood that something was happening. The people in Tuscany in that time understood that something was happening. One of the things that I discovered in my research that I was so fascinated by, and you and I have talked about, is this idea of the Magi, that the same Magi who predicted the birth of Jesus continued to live these traditions throughout Italy, and the same Magi were predicting the births of other important sort of golden children. And at the time, Lorenzo was the golden child who everyone had awaited. And so he is born as a type of new social messiah for his time and is raised to be that. Same thing with Michelangelo. It's not an accident that Michelangelo is named Michelangelo, Archangel Michael. This was not a common name then or now. There was a very specific reason that he was named after the Archangel Michael, and that is because his coming was heralded within those Tuscan families. He was expected. So I told you there's no short answer. Coming back to the Leonardo thing, this was a group of artists who were spiritually trained as well as artistically trained. They were expressing spirit through their art. They understood how to pour their emotion, their intention, their reverence, their devotion into canvas. This is what Botticelli did beautifully, what Donatello did in the most masterful way, and certainly what Michelangelo, who was kind of the baby in this group, he was the youngest, and ultimately perhaps goes on to become the greatest. This is what they knew how to do. Leonardo could not do that, okay? Leonardo, for all of his genius, was a cerebral genius. But what I always say, and I explain this in detail in the book, is that he is cut off from the neck down. Leonardo was never able to connect his art with his heart or with his spirit. So whereas Botticelli is off, you know, accomplishing hundreds of works of art in his time, each one of them more magnificent, more important, more encoded, more perfect than the next, Leonardo couldn't do any of those things. Leonardo accomplished just over a dozen paintings in his entire life in terms of actually completing anything. I don't think that someone who could not complete a painting is someone that we should be celebrating as the, quote, greatest Renaissance genius of his time. So for me, it irritates me, clearly, that we remember Leonardo as the great genius, when in fact the great geniuses were the ones who were so prolific and so devoted to their mission of accomplishing these works of art for posterity, for the future, to protect all of this beautiful information.
Absolutely, and I'm probably repeating myself here, but one of the things I always say about Leonardo is this. First of all, the notebooks, for which he is credited with as somehow having this ingenious mind of doing all of these things, there were notebooks from other books he had access to. Quite a few of them he had access to when, you know, the Botticellis were studying in the Florentine Academy. And he just took notes from other people's work. And biographers of Leonardo accept this, but somehow the PR spin machine continues to be that these are Leonardo's own ideas. They're not. And every time Leonardo tries to accomplish something, he really fails. It's whether it's in painting, he gets the one of the famous scenes, The Last Supper, which he tries to do as a fresco. It's the first time he tries to do a fresco. He tries to mix his paint in a certain way. And all the experts in fresco at that time say, Leonardo, this isn't going to work. You need to listen to us. Leonardo doesn't. And Leonardo finds out that I think within days, if not weeks, of him having begun to do the fresco, it starts to crumble. When he tries to do a very elaborate horse statue in bronze, if I'm not mistaken, the experts say, beautiful, however, we cannot cast this. It is impossible. And so that doesn't get accomplished. And the only thing Leonardo really was interested in, which he, to some extent he was useful for, was his desire to create war machines, which were elaborate and which could be used. But that is so far removed from the Renaissance idea, and also so far removed from the idea we have about Leonardo, that fiction and fact really don't meet when it comes to Leonardo.
Well, he is constantly celebrated. It's always Leonardo the genius, Leonardo the genius. And everyone is always, I get lots of letters. I get letters from people saying, oh, well, the only problem I have with you is that you say these things about Leonardo. And there's a lot of channeled information out there about Leonardo and the Essenes and his commitment to the Magdalene. And it's all crap. I'm sorry, but it is. Because when you start looking at Leonardo, you see that none of those things are true. The commitment to the divine feminine, the commitment to Gnosticism, the commitment to spirituality is alive and well and thriving in Florence, and it is the reason that the Renaissance was successful and golden and changed the world. It is also the reason that Leonardo is sent out of Florence. He is excluded from Florence. He is sent into exile, first into Milan and then into France, because he does not fit in with this Florentine academy. He does not fit in with this greater thinking, which is about celebration and inclusion, and again, and about the whole divine feminine thing. Leonardo didn't like women. He was a misogynist. This is not a secret, and it's not a surprise. If you do any, you know, in-depth searching into his history, you know, Leonardo had mommy issues, and he probably needed a lot of therapy. And that's okay. Most of us do. But, you know, for me, it's just over and over again, we're told that he is the great keeper of the secrets, and he absolutely is not. If he painted secrets into the Last Supper, God bless him, he learned them from his friends in Florence. But what I'm saying is, you know, you've got people coming from all over the world and lined up the Louvre to look at the Mona Lisa, when in fact you've got Botticelli, who has painted the secrets of life and the hermetic principles and everything else in his art. So I just, you know, I tell this one story in The Poet Prince, which I think is really important. And that is a story of how I was once taken in the Uffizi and made to stand in front of a Botticelli Madonna. And it was an experiment in being able to feel the art, because that's one of the things that I write about at length in this book. These artists knew how to infuse emotion and intention and meaning into the work. And if you are standing in front of it, you can feel what they were doing. We also know that the Flemish painters were doing that, and we'll talk about that a little bit, if not today in another show, because Holbein was doing it in his portraits, which is why his portraits were so powerful. But it all really found its glory in the Renaissance. So when you stand in front of a Botticelli painting, you can feel the power. You can feel the emotion that he infuses in these Madonnas. You can also feel the love. There is a devotion to the divine feminine. Every time Botticelli paints a woman, you can feel how much he loves the feminine form, both physically and spiritually. Now, from the Botticelli salon, I was moved into the next room where there is another Madonna. Beautiful, perfectly executed, quite lovely, stood in front of it and felt nothing. And that Madonna, I discovered after the experiment, was a Leonardo da Vinci Madonna, which to me just felt lifeless. Is she beautiful? Yes. Is she technically executed? Yes. Did I feel anything from the painting? No. I don't feel anything from Mona Lisa. I don't feel anything from the Madonna on the rocks. I think I just invented a new cocktail. Madonna on the rocks. I don't feel anything when I stand in front of Leonardo. Does he make me think? Yes. Does he make me feel? No. And that's the difference between these artists.
And I think that's kind of like a good bridge into saying that we stood not in front of the Mona Lisa, but we stood in a very long line three times to see something else, which people, or at least some, about 10, 15 years ago, said was another Leonardo masterpiece, the Turin Shroud. So we went to see the Turin Shroud three times over the course of roughly 24 hours. We were won over, I think, 1.5 million or so who did so. It was a unique experience. As people might know, the last time the Shroud was on exposition was in 2000. And at that moment in time, it was said that the next exposition of the Shroud would be in 2025. However, in 2010, it went on exhibition again in Turin, and we were, as I just said, we were one of the many, many, many who went to see it, and it was an unforgettable experience. First of all, what were your impressions of just the entire event?
In 10 million words or less, you know, we went on. It was interesting to go three different times in a 24-hour period because he went at different times of the day. Every time there was a line, except when we had tickets to go late at night, and then the last time we went was great because we were the last people in the cathedral. But just to give you an idea, the way the Shroud is displayed in the cathedral in Turin. You have to, even with an appointment and a ticket time, you have to wait in an extremely long line. It's still at least an hour wait to get in. You are shepherded into small groups to stand in front of it, and you get about 3 minutes. So it's a little bit frustrating, actually, because you do feel very rushed, and you don't really get to sort of, you know, stand in front of it and absorb it. So I was really happy that we had made the decision in advance to get three different ticket times so that we could spend more time. And then at the end of it, they opened it up to a late night ticketing. So we had the last ticket time, I think, at 10 or 10:30. So there was a big difference. There was a big difference in going at 11 o'clock in the afternoon and, you know, arriving in the middle of the day. Even though you have tickets to see the Shroud in this sort of private space, the cathedral is still open, so there's still tons of people. So, you know, there's this constant sort of energy and distraction and that kind of thing. But here's what I want to say about the Shroud. The first time I went to Egypt in 1992, I was certain that I had seen every picture of the pyramids that it is possible to see. The pyramids have become so iconic in everything that we see in terms of pictures and art and the National Geographic Channel and all those other things that I never in a million years thought that the pyramids would surprise me. But the first time you see the pyramids in person is a life-changing experience. You realize that there is nothing, there is no photograph in the world, there is no video in the world, there is no art in the world that captures what it feels like to be on that plateau in Egypt. I have not had that feeling again until the first time I stood in front of the Shroud of Turin last month. I thought, I have so many books on the Shroud, I have watched every movie, DVD, documentary that there is on the Shroud, in many cases, over and over again. And I thought, I have seen this picture of this object so many times. I've gone to see replicas in Rome over the years. I've seen perfect photographic replicas on display in Rome. I thought there is no way that seeing this object in person is really going to be that different. And I was so wrong. There is something indescribably powerful about being in the presence of this object. Whatever you believe about the Shroud, I wish every skeptic in the world could stand in front of it just for a few minutes, because even if you remain skeptical, there is an element of whatever this is, it's important, it's powerful, it represents some aspect of the human experience that is absolutely undeniable. I'm going to throw it back to you because I want to hear what you thought about it and your immediate impressions, and then we'll talk about, I want to talk about some of the specific details that really, really captured me, but I want to hear what your initial impression was.
Well, definitely. Originally we had just one ticket to go and see it at, I think, 11 o'clock in the morning, and that was kind of, to me, the disappointing one, if that makes sense. It's rush hour. You are in the middle of the day. They know that there are thousands and thousands of people. Plus, as we found out, it was a Wednesday, so in the afternoon there were going to be lots of people with wheelchairs, which puts additional stress on the people who are organizing it. And even though they were all brilliant, at the end of the day, you know, it's kind of like management of people through an object which is, in my opinion, much larger than I thought it would actually be, even though, again, I knew what the dimensions were. But, you know, that kind of was to me, okay, this is, if you just see it once, you could get away thinking, okay, it's just an object. But the nighttime sessions on both occasions, the first one, but specifically the last one, when you are able to stand in the object and be relaxed about it and not be rushed, it's almost as if it's got its own heartbeat. It's like, you know, it draws to you. And we've been doing a lot of research into the Shroud, and we have seen people like Margaret of Austria specifically, who were in love with this, who ascribe magical properties to it, who, you know, try to do preserve it and taught other people, other women, how to first of all take care of it, but also, I believe, some of the magical qualities it had. And specifically in the third session, that just became crystal clear to me, that the more you are in front of this object, and the more you can be in front of this object, the more convinced you are of its power. And we'll come back to that when we start talking about Shard, probably, and Labyrinth, because I think it's got the same effect. But I understand to some extent also why people are afraid of putting it on permanent display. To some extent, if the Shroud was on permanent display, there wouldn't be this gigantic management of crowds. But I also think people would, you and I, we would go back and back and back and stand in front of that for hours. And I think certain things might begin to happen to people, specifically like you, who are standing in what the church would call too long in front of the Shroud.
But why is that a bad thing?
Because we all know that the church doesn't really like this experience of divine contact. They prefer it to be the middleman. And I also think to some extent that is why, apart from the fact that there are millions of people, and again, it was really well organized. I loved the way it was organized. It was very well done. Even though you were rushed through, it didn't feel like you were rushed through. And they were rushing you through because they knew that there were literally millions like you who wanted to see it. But I also think it's the other, the little thing which the church realizes is that if you only get a tiny bit of exposure, you will not get the full effect. And again, we went three times, and specifically the last time when we had about, I think, 7 minutes really up close, and then we went into the main part of the cathedral where you could still see it for a bit longer, even though you're further away from it. Again, and I think that's not a coincidence, that you kind of like, you know, you're allowed to stay in front of it much longer, but you've got to be further back. I think all of those things the church knows. I think the church pretty much knows what it's got there, and I think it also is a bit of a sore issue for them, because they can't really destroy it. I think they would want it to go away, but two fires, tremendous fires, one in 1532 and one in the last century, this thing has got a mind of its own. Just looking at the detail, it's almost magical to see. Everybody knows the image of the Shroud, and it's you know, world famous. But then when you start looking at the damage which has been done to the Shroud through these fires, it literally stops at the image. There is no kind of, if you were to do a statistical analysis, you would think, okay, damage to the Shroud by fire is going to be haphazard. It's going to be here and then a bit there. But the image has been untouched. And there was one point in the, between the arms and the torso where literally the fire damage stops at the arm and stops at the torso. It's as if, like, you know, there's some kind of divine protection of the image. You shall not burn me. It's magical to see.
It is magical to see, and it's something that you don't see. You know, the photographs don't capture it. The video images don't capture it. Gosh, there are so many different things I want to say here. First of all, is I don't need or want the church to determine how much time I am allowed to have in front of these holy relics, and that's a problem for me. And I actually do believe that one, it is time management was necessary, and I have to give definite props to the Archdiocese of Turin, who did an incredible job in terms of keeping those crowds moving and making everything happen. But I stand by my assertion that if the Shroud were on display regularly, you would not have these kinds of crowds. You know, there are so many advances in technology now to protect it so that it is not in danger by too much light and that type of thing, that I don't see any reason. They have spent so much money, they have spent millions creating showcases for the Shroud so that it can be viewed in a way that is safe. It's behind bulletproof glass, it's in this extraordinary, you know, gigantic reliquary that lays it out so that it's 14 feet long, you know, all of these things. I don't understand why they can't keep it up there all the time, or at least some period of time. If they say we're going to keep the shroud available through the period of Lent every year, if there was some way that people knew they could always go and see it, stand in front of it, have this experience, you know, with it. I'd like to stay there all day, you know. I know that the longer I am in front of it, the more I'm going to get from the experience. Some of that is emotional and spiritual, and some of it is strictly observational. For example, I noticed things on the third viewing that I did not notice in the first two, because we were there longer, and also depending on where you're standing in your particular viewing. You know, at one point I was standing at the head, at another point I was standing at the bottom of the, you know, at the bottom of the back, at the feet. Now, what I noticed there was incredibly powerful. For me, one of the things that really got my attention was the dorsal side, the back side of the shroud to me was actually the emotional side. There are elements to the way the back, the wounds on the back of the body are very disturbing to see in person. But for me, one of the piece that really got me was the back of the feet. The back of the feet and the legs, where you can see where the blood has pooled from the nail wounds in the feet, is incredibly powerful, and it's quite disturbing. And I remember looking at that thinking, the way that that blood pools, now I'm not a CSI expert, but I just cannot imagine anyone creating that. It was one of the elements that feels so authentic to me. I mean, we've done other shows on the shroud, and certainly we've gone into the fact that the carbon dating we know is wrong. And that was another thing that was very interesting for me. To see the shroud in person, you see where the pieces of linen were cut to do the carbon dating, and you also see that they're not part of the original shroud. And it's so obvious. It's so obviously not part of the original shroud, because these extra strips were added to the shroud in the late Middle Ages in order to protect it. And you can see so clearly in person the places, these rectangular spaces that were cut out for the carbon dating, and also see that it's not part of the original shroud. So it just feels so obvious to me that, you know, these, quote, tests that were done to date the shroud just have no validity whatsoever. I mean, it's almost ridiculous. So anyway, there are so many elements here, but I really do wish the church would open this up. And one of the things that we did notice on this last trip to Rome is that more and more of the relics are being kept away from the public. Even just in the last 3 years, 3 years ago, when I was in Rome, I went to the Church of the Holy Church of Jerusalem, which is where the primary concentration of holy relics from the Holy Land that were brought by Constantine's mother are in this church. And that is the largest piece of the Crown of Thorns, the largest piece of the True Cross outside of the private offices of the Vatican, and the titular. The titular is the INRI sign, written in three languages by the hand of Pontius Pilate. It's an extraordinary relic. And, you know, the authentication of these relics, I think is pretty legitimate. And I was there 3 years ago, and I was really impressed by how easy it was to access this chapel that they were in, how you could go right up to the relics, how beautiful they were, how powerful it was. Everything about it was lovely. This year, 3 years later, the chapel's there. You can go into the chapel, but it's now blocked off. You can't get within 20 feet of the relics. You can only view them from a distance. And perhaps not accidentally, it is blocked off with offering boxes. So you're allowed to give offerings to the church, who will no longer let you see their relics up close, but you're not allowed to see the relics up close. So this, you know, continued effort by Benedict and his crew to separate us from having an authentic personal experience with those elements that really are from the first century is something that is a huge frustration for me.
And that brings us, I think, to something which, once again, we were able to walk, even though the church there is trying to make it as hard as possible as we can as well, which is the Chartres Labyrinth, which we managed to walk, as I said. We walked it actually quite a few times this time. Chartres Labyrinth is still open on Fridays, roughly between Easter and the end of September, roughly between the hours of 9 o'clock until 5:30, unless there's a special event, which sometimes there is. There's a mass, which was once again extremely well attended by about a dozen people, and that meant that the labyrinth was covered up with chairs. And once again, like we have been saying, the labyrinth is proving to be more popular than masses within Chartres Cathedral. And last year it was very disturbing what they were doing specifically to you when you were walking it. This year they largely left you alone, though the leafleting saying that the Chartres Labyrinth is all to do with eternal life and basically dying a good death are still there, and the very same pamphlets which refer to the source of miracles without naming it, and the Book of Love somewhat less implicitly than the source of miracles, are still there, and everybody actually begins to read them. I actually noticed that the casual visitor who quite often congregates at the chairs at the end of the church is kind of like reading them in anticipation of their tour guides. Tour guides who were very funny this year. There was one guy who walked a labyrinth for his entire group and basically created a very bizarre ritual hall by themselves. But I also found that the labyrinth kind of like, you know, needs to have a proper code of conduct, which actually the church has kind of like put there, saying this is the way you should walk it. But there was one extremely disturbing thing, both for you and I, which is that a woman who wanted to walk the labyrinth decided to put her bag in the center of the labyrinth, and then decided to walk it, then decided to stand in the center of the labyrinth for a long period of time, which isn't a problem, except that her bag was there, and then she piled another bag on top.
And let's just be clear here. When you say bag, we're not talking about a purse. We're talking about luggage. We're talking about someone who dragged her luggage into the center of the labyrinth. I mean, which part of this is sacred space, people, do you not understand? And this is the thing that drives me crazy when I'm in Chartres, is how unconscious people are in this space. Now, the people who are looking up and never look down, and they're only looking at stained glass and taking photographs and don't even realize there's a labyrinth under their feet, I can actually, you know, I can excuse that behavior because they just don't know. But people who are going there to walk the labyrinth and then behave in this incredibly unconscious way where they're disrupting this experience for everybody else. You know, we have to share this space. This is a shared communal space, and I think that's part of the lesson of it. I think that's the beautiful and the challenging thing about the way the labyrinth is currently set up. It is open so infrequently. It is only available for those handful of hours on Fridays for half of the year, that we have to learn how to share it. And so when I see someone come in like that and do something that is that self-centered and disrupts the experience for an hour for the hundreds of people who are waiting their turn to get inside of it, it's such a paradox for me. It's how can you come to a place that's about consciousness intentionally and then be completely unconscious? So that was a big challenge for me this year. I found that most of my time in the labyrinth was spent praying for the consciousness of this incredible environment to really start having an impact on people, and most specifically on the people who work there, because I'm nervous. I'm nervous about what's happening in France right now, and I'm nervous about what's happening with these monuments. I'm nervous about what's going to happen with the labyrinth as they continue to restore Chartres. They're doing extraordinary restoration. It's very beautiful, but the restoration of the nave begins next year, and how that's going to affect the labyrinth, we don't yet know, and I'm very concerned about that. So please, please, please keep your good intentions and your prayers towards the labyrinth and towards keeping it open and protected, because I think that it might be in danger. I don't want to be an alarmist. I certainly don't want to put that energy towards it, but I am nervous.
And definitely the labyrinth might be closed at best for two years, depending. When you look at the original timeline as to the restoration of the south side. That took somewhat longer than anticipated. They are now beginning work on the west side, the main entrance. And when we were there, they were just putting up the scaffolding, which they had to put some of it inside. And as nice as the workmen were, you are working with wood and metal. And sometimes I saw one man trying to dislodge a metal rod, and he was trying his best to do it as quietly as he could, but it just didn't want to move, and so he had to call in colleagues, and they made an awful lot of noise, but it was kind of, you know, they couldn't do it any other way, because obviously that they work during the same hours that labyrinth is open and the church is open. So once that work moves from the outside to the inside, there's a potential specifically for health and safety, even though France isn't as strict as countries like Britain and America is on health and safety. There's a very strong likelihood that the labyrinth might have to be closed for some of the restoration, and that means potentially for, you know, 2 years. And even though the restoration work is not really run by the church or by church funds, you just know that the church is going to use the fact that this has to happen for all of the wrong reasons. So it's going to be interesting to see what the church is going to do once that decision of whether the labyrinth should be closed or not for the restoration of 2011, 2012, what it's going to do, whether it's going to use that event for all the wrong reasons. And what I found somewhat better is that they seem to have put a guy in charge of clearing and opening, clearing and closing the labyrinth, and he was actually pretty good about it. He kind of, like, you know, he said, in 20 minutes I need to put the chairs back, in 5 minutes I need to put the chairs back, whereas last year it was just like, okay, get out of here, kind of like, you know, you are no longer welcome here. And so it was slightly more reverential and slightly more, oh, these people who walk the labyrinths are actually human beings. But then the summer solstice has just happened yesterday, and we learned that for the first time the labyrinth would not be open on the summer solstice. So that is a very worrying conclusion to see as well.
Yeah, it is, because they've always opened the labyrinth, or at least in the last 10 years, they've opened the labyrinth on the summer solstice. Magical things happen in Chartres on the summer solstice, and actually during this week, and I've written about them in my books. And people come from all over Europe to celebrate there. Now, I have not got my report from Sharp back from yesterday, so I don't know exactly what happened yet, but when we were there, we were told by several people that we know there who run labyrinth events in France. They said that they were told by the church that they had decided that it was a pagan celebration to come there on the summer solstice, and as a result, the church would no longer allow the labyrinth to be open on the summer solstice because they would not encourage that. Of course, I find that to be tragic and stupid and unfortunate and close-minded. And again, this is that sort of trend towards, you know, closing everything down and separating us from, you know, our ability to have these, you know, beautiful, extraordinary experiences that our ancestors certainly knew and had and celebrated. One thing about Chartres, and then I want to talk about another labyrinth in the area. One of the things we did, which was a really interesting exercise, is we went through the cathedral and we counted the chairs. And I don't have my notes in front of me, so I can't give you the exact number, but here was sort of our thinking on this. They will close the labyrinth on the days that it's open during Mass, despite the fact that the cathedral is larger than the average football stadium, and therefore you could have a labyrinth walk and a Mass going on at the same time, and never the twain shall meet. There is no really an intersection of those two things, because there is so much space between them that neither interferes with the other. But the fact is, I have watched these Masses over the last 2 years that have caused the labyrinth to close, and I have seen the attendance be anywhere from 3 people to 15 people. 3 to 15 people total, attending these masses at the time they close the labyrinth, whereas the labyrinth will sometimes have 50 to 100, even 200 people in the back of the cathedral waiting to walk the labyrinth or somehow preparing to walk the labyrinth. So the fact is, those who are coming to see the labyrinth are now outnumbering those who are attending the masses by 10 times, sometimes 20 times or more. So it seems to me that maybe the church needs to wake up to it, or maybe the problem is the church is waking up to it and they're becoming more and more nervous about it. So in counting the chairs, what did we discover?
Well, first of all, that there are roughly the cathedral can hold 2,000 people. The labyrinth space is occupying about 500 chairs. I was told that attendance of Mass, because of the economic crisis, has actually sometimes gone to as much as 25 a day.
Wow.
So, you know, somehow it seems that the 1,500 chairs, which would be there anyway, without an additional 500 covering up the labyrinth, they can pretty much cope with 25, even if they're 50, even if they're 1,000. They can cope with it.
So that's our point. There is no need for those chairs in the labyrinth. There are 1,500 seats in that cathedral without the chairs that are on the labyrinth for a mass that averages 20 people.
And the other thing which I find is that I get the fact that, you know, as usual, we go into churches and sometimes, like in Vézelay, for example, we were there when there was a church service going on. And they close off certain sections of the church saying, no guided visits, no nothing, no visiting here during Mass. I get that. But in short, it's a double-edged sword. They don't stop tours from going on during church Masses. You know, they don't stop anything else. They don't close the shop.
They don't close the shop.
Everything is business as usual during Mass, except the labyrinth. The labyrinth somehow it cannot be open at the same time as the Mass is being said, even though there are, you know, at one point a Mass was going, I think it was last year, a Mass was going on, and I didn't even see the priest or the congregation. I just kind of thought, there's a crypt, kind of, you know, and I very well knew that even though there is a crypt, you can't hear anything what's going on in the crypt in the main part of the cathedral. But kind of, you know, because it's so gigantic and you hear this Mass, your mind starts to play tricks on you. So there's no way, anything going on in the labyrinth can somehow interfere with what goes on in the church. Specifically not, because what we have now is slightly weird as well. You see people congregating, waiting for the labyrinth to open up again, almost kind of like willing the priest to stop and get it over and done with, because they want to do something themselves. So it's a very weird situation, but I guess the overall conclusion is that's shorter for you. Now, a very other weird situation, as always, because that's the nature of the place, is Rennes-le-Château, which we visited as well. And Rennes-le-Château, of course, is the cornerstone of so many books, including The Expected One. And this year we did, we revisited certain places which you had written about in The Expected One, which I had visited a very long time ago. And you also showed me some of the sites which I actually hadn't been to, like St. Baume and Vézelay. And then we also did places connected to other parts of the First Family, like Avignon and Tarascon, which are specifically linked to Martha. And we also attended the Gypsy Festival at Sainte Marie de la Mer. So we had a very intense, probably about 10 days on the trail of the Magdalene in the south of France. Now, to start off with the most famous example, probably, Rennes-le-Château. Rennes-le-Château is pretty much business as usual in my book. The church continues to crumble away, largely due to the fact that it is aging and there are really no funds to restore it properly. The garden is still run by the amazing Toby and Gerda. Whatever you do when you visit Rennes-le-Château, visit the garden. The garden of Mary is the best way to describe it is the experience Jesus had when he walked into Martha's garden is precisely the experience you will have when you walk into the Villa Betania. It's a it's a delight to be there. It's the best kind of atmosphere you get. You feel that every single table is kind of, has the sole attention of the owners and the people who run the bar. It's extremely well done, with extreme detail, with extreme attention to detail, and with extreme love. So again, to underline the work which Toby and Gerda are doing in the garden, but also almost preserving the village, it has just been phenomenal. And kudos to them, because they were given a task when Jean-Luc Robert died a few years ago. They had let out a garden to him, and the fact that his unfortunate death meant that they had to make a very big decision to personally engage into something which, Toby and Gerda are not at all old, but to start off a big initiative to do these things almost 7 days a week, for extreme amounts of time, is an extraordinary engagement, and they do it tremendously well and tremendously deep, and they are a very great blessing, and it really is the place where you will meet everybody. For those who go to Rennes Chateau to meet Henry Lincoln, when we were there in the past year, Henry was normally there on a Sunday. You will now find Henry pretty much there every single day.
He's there pretty much every day. Yeah, Henry's easy to find now in the garden, and he is more than happy to answer questions about his books and give people tours of the church. Rennes Chateau has become an amazing community, and I really have to credit Toby and Gerda. Toby and Gerda Dobler are an extraordinary German couple who have been in Rennes Chateau since 1995, have been very, very singularly devoted to its preservation and its restoration. They do run this extraordinary garden, and the beauty of it is it is the original garden of the Villa Bethania, which is now open to the public as a restaurant and a bar. By the way, the food's amazing. But the beauty of it really is Toby and Gerda and the hospitality, the way that they make Rennes Chateau come alive for you when you are in the garden, is, I think, extraordinary. I think it's the best thing that's happened in that village in many, many years. And the beauty of it is that, the Villa Bethania was named after this home of Martha. And if ever there was an incarnation of Martha on earth, it is Gerda Dobler. I mean, there is nobody who understands hospitality and comfort and nurturing like this woman. And she really brings the spirit of Martha alive in this place. It's an extraordinary experience. So I'm actually loving what Rennes Chateau has turned into. It's become much warmer, much more welcoming. It's such a beautiful place to be these days, with one sad exception.
And that is that, I mean, when we're talking about Rennes Chateau, we are talking about Treasure Seekers Central. For many years, people came here because, wasn't it a fact that Saunière left or found this gigantic treasure which made everybody rich? So people came there in search of this treasure, and that is the initial pool of attraction. And I think, Toby and Gerda have moved that so far away from it. The problem is also that Rennes Chateau, even though there are very few people living there, people are still living there. And a few years ago, for example, some person thought that the treasure of Rennes Chateau was buried underneath the water tower, as a result of which the water tower got dynamited, and for 6 months people in Rennes Chateau had no running water. That thing continues to exist, and we were walking around the garden in front of the church, which is a garden which Saunière did, and there are some pretty clear signs of, if you know what to look for, you will see that there's some pretty clear signs of vandalism, specifically with the Calvary cross and the inverted Visigothic pillar, on top of which sits a statue of the Virgin Mary, which is kind of like plastered against the Villa Bethania proper. So it's a bit of a disturbing trend to see that the treasure hunter seems to be back. It's not a good thing, and I hope that the treasure hunter stays very much at the foot of the hill rather than makes his presence known again. There was supposed to be a treasure hunter conference to be held in June, which for organizatorial reasons didn't happen, and I'm actually quite happy to see that didn't happen, because the real treasure of Rennes Chateau has got very little to do with a physical treasure. I have been writing some articles on my website, which, yes, Sonnier was extremely rich, but that has nothing to do with what he was doing. Kind of, you know, he didn't stumble across gazillions amount of money lying underneath the village. Kathleen, in your books, you have made exactly the same point. And you know, to some extent, over the past 10 to 15 years, that treasure hunter mentality has moved out of the village, finally, and let's hopefully keep it like that. I was a bit disturbed to see that it almost kind of like, you know, was entering the village once again. For the moment, kind of like, you know, it's an orange light. It's not a red one, but it's definitely an orange, and I think it's going to remain an orange for another year or two before we see that it's going to go back to a green one.
Well, when it's clear that the treasure hunters are vandalizing monuments that were built by Sonnier, are using, you know, hammers and chisels and even larger implements to actually, you know, crack apart blocks in the foundations of these crosses, that's vandalism. I don't care what they call it. I don't care what they think they're looking for. They are vandalizing spiritual monuments. They are vandalizing monuments that belong to the people of France. And that's just not acceptable to me. And you know what? I know who did this. You know who did this. And we're not going to mention names, not even because we're afraid of exposing them, because I don't want to give them the satisfaction of talking about them by name. But here's what I want to say. Those of you who care about these mysteries, those of you who care about places like Rennes-le-Château, those of you who want to preserve them, I beg of you, do not spend your money on books and movies and DVDs about discovering things that is helping to finance these people who are vandalizing this village, who are going in there at night with sledgehammers because they think it's okay for them to destroy anything they want to so they can go and make a movie about it, which you are going to go pay money for. Please, I bet it's kind of like buying dolphin safe tuna, you know? If you can't, you have to be conscious about what you are doing. And I beg of you, almost to the point of boycott, please be very wary of these people who call themselves treasure seekers, who are holding treasure seeker conferences, and who are claiming to discover hidden treasures, oh, I don't know, hidden tombs, things like that in the region, because most of them are vandals who are just out to make as much money as they can and destroy whatever they have to do in the process. It is wrong, and I beg of you not to support them.
And again, kind of, you know, I can probably spoil the plot of all of these things, even future ones. They will kind of like tell you that they might potentially have found something, but it's actually not as kind of like, you know, all clear cut, and there will either be a vast conspiracy against them to kind of like uncover, or they will be intimidated or something like that. But the best one was actually a guy from the Vatican. When Bruce Burgess did his documentary, he got some kind of fame by the fact that some of the CNNs and the other ones kind of took it up. And Bruce Burgess was claiming that he had found, together with the people he was interviewing, the tomb of Mary Magdalene in the region. And he kind of like, you know, he had I can't remember which channel it was on, but one of the American news channels, actually might have been Fox News, actually. Might be the only thing Fox News actually did well. They had a guy over from, actually on a direct feed from Italy, and he was a junior member of the Vatican, a priest, obviously. And they said, you know, we have Bruce Burgess here in the studio who claims that he might potentially have found the body of Mary Magdalene. What's your opinion about that? And the guy very straightforwardly said, well, if that's the case, the Vatican would not send me as the spokesperson. Oh, by the way, you know, you would not have Bruce Burgess in your studio, but you would have some gigantically huge archaeologist or some other gigantically huge person sitting there. You would not have a junior guy from the Vatican talking to an extremely unknown television producer. And I think that kind of like summed up the entire controversy, which is unique to Rennes-le-Château, whereby literally it's a mountain out of a molehill. As beautiful as the drive is, and however long it takes, When you look at it to the surrounding landscape, you always find that it is actually a really small mountain. That is quite often the case when all of these stories about the treasure seekers of Rennes-le-Château do get exposed. It's really kind of like, a really tiny controversy, however big they are trying to make it into. And I think that's the sad part, that kind of attention-grabbing headlines is back. To some extent, the Da Vinci Code effect has worn off. In the immediate aftermath of the Da Vinci Code, everybody was very happy to kind of like say what was the mystery of Rennes-le-Château. Now they seem to be once again trying to spin something and make the mystery of Rennes-le-Château into something which it isn't, and enlarge upon it. And that, again, is somewhat of a worrying trend. Now, unfortunately, or fortunately, we have reached the end of this edition, and we haven't actually spoken about On the Footsteps of Mary Magdalene in the South of France, so we'll kind of come back to that probably the next time around. But in the meantime, we are continuing on the footsteps of so many things, and the Spirit Revolution is definitely happening, and we are monitoring, and we are going to be back next week. So from Kathleen and I,
the truth against the world.